The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Ed Tremblay from the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from the Tar Heel Junior Historian Magazine, North Carolina History for Students. Be resuming volume 58, number 2, which is the spring 2019 issue of the Tar Heel Junior Historian, which is about the 1960s. How does change happen? First article today will be Nina Simone, What More Can I Say? By Catherine Hunter Williams, who is on the faculty of the Department of Dramatic Art at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. She is the performance director for Hidden Voices, a nonprofit dedicated to bringing life-changing stories into a public forum. To learn more, you can go to www.hiddenvoices.org. There are so many good ways to learn history. How about going to a play? In the fall of 2015, Durham playwright Howard Kraft asked me if I would direct a play he was writing. I love doing plays. I have worked at Playmakers Repertory Company in Chapel Hill as an actor for many years, and have also directed dozens of plays for Hidden Voices, a collaborative nonprofit theater group. I happily said, "What is the play about?" "Nina Simone," he answered. My heart leaped in my throat. Nina Simone? The famous singer, the woman whose voice was part of the soundtrack of the civil rights movement in the 1960s? Of course I wanted to be part of this story. For many young people, Nina Simone is not a name they recognize, so I was honored to take part in telling her story to a new audience. The theater is in a unique position to bring history to life. Through the medium of theater, an entire community can sit together and share a live experience. Dr. Joseph Jordan, director of the Sonia Haynes Stone Center for Black Culture and History, had commissioned Howard to write a play that would accompany their exhibit on Nina Simone in 2015. The 1960s was an exciting, beautiful, violent, and inspiring time. Every decade has a sound that is part of its identity. The 1940s had the big band sound, the 1950s was rock and roll, and the 1960s had music that inspired a movement, the civil rights movement. Music was sung as protesters marched in the streets. It was sung in jails to keep everyone's spirits up. It was sung at funerals in a somber reflection of the many lives lost to violence. We had so many famous singers adding their voices to the call for equality. North Carolina native Nina Simone was, for many, the beacon of light during those dark and troubled days. Nina Simone was born Eunice Kathleen Wayman in Tryon in 1933. She was the sixth of eight children. Eunice was so naturally talented that she started playing the piano when she was three. And by the time she was seven, she was playing piano and organ in the church where her mother was a minister. Can you imagine? Growing up in Tryon was not easy in those days. Like many African Americans, Eunice encountered a lot of racism. But her piano teacher, Muriel Mazanovich, nurtured her musical talent. Eunice was a truly gifted classical pianist. After graduating from high school, Eunice auditioned for the prestigious Curtis Institute of Music in Philadelphia, but she was denied entrance because of her race. In order to support herself, she began singing in nightclubs. But what would her religious parents back home think about that? So she came up with a stage name, Nina Simone. At the time, she had no way of knowing how famous that name would become. Simone became a singing sensation in the 50s and released her first album in 1959. This is why her voice was so powerful in the civil rights movement. As an established star, she sang songs that helped to heal and inspire the community. She became known as the High Priestess of Soul. With her voice, she became a master storyteller. In the play Nina Simone, What More Can I Say? One actress is on the stage portraying Nina from childhood through adulthood. The actress Yolanda Rabin was a smash as she dramatized the different moments of Nina's life. In the following excerpt from the play, the actress describes how Nina felt after the bombing that occurred at the African American 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham, Alabama on Sunday, September 15th, 1963. I still get angry when I think about what America put my people through. I remember I was at my apartment in Mount Vernon, where I practice sometimes, the day those four little girls in Birmingham were blown up in that church. September 15th, 1963. It came over the radio and hit me in the face like a brick. Their names were Addie Mae Collins, Carol Robertson, Cynthia Wesley, and Denise McNair. The youngest girl was 11. Can you imagine losing a child that way? Blown up by some coward's bomb in a church, a house of God? I wanted to shoot somebody, and I was justified in that feeling. But that wasn't my place, as my husband reminded me. I was a singer and a musician, and a singer sings songs. So I sang songs that would give light and darkness and warm hearts on long, cold marches. I sang songs that people could carry like meals in the lunch boxes of their spirit. Songs that could give them sustenance on freedom's long, long road. I remember the night we flew in to perform after the Selma to Montgomery march. 40,000 people. Langston Hughes, Leonard Bernstein, Shelley Winters, Harry Belafonte, all kinds of people were there, and armed gangs of racists were waiting with hate in their eyes and death in their hands. We slept in one room that night. On the rooftops all around our hotel, federal marshals stood with rifles. The tension was thick, and fear made it hard to breathe. But then, old Langston smiles. Langston got to telling stories and telling lies, and we got to singing, and we chased fear right out of that room. We knew what most of our grandchildren and children have forgotten, but we have to be their memory. You, black grandmothers and grandfathers, you have to let them know what it was like and what we had to do to get to where we are and how far we still need to go. You have to be their memory. Stands, sings, holding scrapbook to chest. To be young, gifted, and black. Oh, what a lovely, precious dream. To be young, gifted, and black. Open your heart to what I mean. When you feel really low, yeah, there's a great truth you should know. When you're young, gifted, and black, your soul's intact. Recites last verse. Oh, but my joy of today is that we can all be proud to say, to be young, gifted, and black is where it's at, raises the Black Power salute. Telling the story of Nina Simone in the theater is powerful because Nina was a wonderful, hypnotic, spellbinding storyteller. You can listen to her singing the song Young, Gifted, and Black on the following YouTube link. YOUTUBE.BE/RRCAPITAL, capital R, capital T, capital G, lowercase I, capital K, capital Y, lowercase Q, lowercase K, the number 0, lowercase G, uppercase Y. Nina would move away from the United States for most of her last years. The pain of losing Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and the injustices she saw many African Americans suffer prompted her to leave the United States in the 1970s. Nina died April 21, 2003 in France. Music had always helped people endure difficult changes. Today we can look back at the life and times of Nina Simone and reflect on how important her music was to the civil rights movement. Her passion and her dedication to equal rights for everyone are just as potent today as in 1968. As North Carolinians, we have so much to be proud of, and Nina Simone is one of our treasures. Carly Jones, musical director for the North Carolina Arts Council, notes, Nina Simone's birthplace and childhood home was designated as a national treasure by the National Trust for Historic Preservation. The birthplace joins the Pauli Murray House in Durham as only the second national treasure in North Carolina and one of the few in the country dedicated to African American women. As a result of this designation, a campaign has been launched to fundraise for the preservation of the Nina Simone birthplace. Both the North Carolina Arts Council and the North Carolina African American Heritage Commission are working together on the project. As a director, I hope this theatrical staging about the powerful Nina Simone will be performed again one day. Her haunting and poetic voice, her dedication to truth and justice, and her demand for equality can still inspire all of us today. Here are the captions that go with the photos. Poster for the 2012 exhibit, Nina Simone, What More Can I Say, at the Sonia Haynes Stone Center for Black Culture and History at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. On the poster, it says, Nina Simone, What More Can I Say, the Robert and Sally Brown Gallery and Museum of the Sonia Haynes Stone Center for Black Culture and History, September 13th, 2012 to November 30th, 2012. Another photo, a young Nina Simone, then Eunice Wayman. At age 8, she was already a talented pianist. A poster for the Howard Kraft play, Nina Simone, What More Can I Say? And Lisa Simone Kelly, daughter of Nina Simone, kisses the statue of her mother at the unveiling ceremony in the singer's hometown of Tryon, February 21st, 2010. The statue was created by award-winning sculptor Zenos Froudakis. Actress Yolanda Rabin on stage is Nina Simone in the play Nina Simone, What More Can I Say? Fun fact, Rabin is a familiar face at the North Carolina Museum of History. She appears in several History Museum videos on demand, including 585 Days, if you're lucky, and the new Quilt Speak series. Stream these and other videos from our website, ncmuseumofhistory.org. There's also a sidebar article, Saving Nina's Childhood Home. Nina Simone's birthplace and childhood home, located in Tryon, has recently been designated a national treasure by the National Trust for Historic Preservation. Both the North Carolina Arts Council and the North Carolina African American Heritage Commission are working together to renovate and preserve the home. To learn more, go to savingplaces.org. Next article, Conservatives in the 1960s by Benjamin C. Waterhouse, who teaches the history of business and economics, politics and political thought, and capitalism at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He is the author of Lobbying America, The Politics of Business from Nixon to NAFTA, published by the Princeton University Press in 2014. Conservatism is defined as a political philosophy that advocates limited government, free markets, and traditional values. It was late in the fall semester in 1962, and more than 1,000 UNC students turned out to hear world-famous folk singer Pete Seeger. Crammed into Memorial Hall, they sang along to classic folk songs as well as new songs inspired by the growing movement for civil rights and racial equality for Black Americans, especially the anthem, We Shall Overcome. But not everyone was happy about the concert. Outside the hall, about 20 students protested with picket signs, urging their classmates not to go in. Save your dollars for democracy, one sign read. What was going on? The 1960s often conjures images of rebellious young people growing their hair long, taking drugs, or even dropping out of straight society to live a hippie counterculture lifestyle. We often think of in the streets marches for social change, racial equality, rights for women and LGBTQ people, and opposition to the war in Vietnam. But most Americans were not hippies, radical leftists, or social activists. And while the anti-Vietnam movement was very vocal, a majority of Americans actually supported the war until the early 1970s. Many thought the anti-war protesters were traitors. In addition, while many white Americans supported civil rights for African Americans, others actively resisted the black freedom movement. Others approved of racial equality in principle, but opposed specific remedies for racial injustice, like busing students to different schools to achieve racial integration, or creating anti-poverty programs aimed at racial minorities. In short, the 1960s was a time of significant social and political conservatism on many fronts. Conservatism in the 1960s extended, perhaps surprisingly, to college campuses. One of the most influential conservative student groups was Young Americans for Freedom, YAF. YAF was founded in 1960, shortly before Democrat John F. Kennedy defeated Republican Richard Nixon in that year's presidential election. In September, 90 young people, mostly white men from well-to-do East Coast families, held a meeting in Sharon, Connecticut. Their host was William F. Buckley, Jr., a 34-year-old writer who had shot to fame for a book he wrote while a student at Yale. That work, Man and God at Yale, published in 1951, criticized his alma mater, claiming it had abandoned traditional Christian values. It launched Buckley's career as a public intellectual and publisher of conservative magazine National Review. YAF chapters soon formed around the country, and its members worked for Republican politicians like Barry Goldwater and Ronald Reagan. What did it mean for a young conservative to be a young conservative in the 1960s? The founders of YAF wrote a mission statement called the Sharon Statement. It defined conservatism as fundamentally a defense of individual people's liberty, the right to be free from the restrictions of arbitrary force. They believed the biggest threat to personal freedom came from concentrated political and economic power. YAF members supported a restrained federal government and a market economy free from interference. Any policy that takes from one man to bestow on another, including the minimum wage, Social Security, or public schools, would reduce the moral and physical strength of the nation. Most important, the young conservatives declared that international communism was the single greatest threat to these liberties. They took a hard line on the Cold War between the United States and the Soviet Union, whose economic model rejected capitalism. In their clothes, hairstyles, and social attitudes, young conservatives were traditional, especially compared to their more radical classmates. But being politically conservative did not mean being quiet or reserved, quite the opposite. Many quickly established a reputation for being active and even aggressive organizers and protesters. At UNC Chapel Hill, conservative students formed a chapter of Young Americans for Freedom in the spring of 1962. Within a year, the group established itself as a force against liberalism and leftism on campus. Among other ideas, they protested the Pro-Civil Rights Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC. When Pete Seeger sang to raise money for SNCC, YAF members called it a red-inspired concert. The term red was slang for communist. That activism gave them a reputation at the campus newspaper as the other group that pickets. When the Vietnam War escalated, grew in size or intensity, in the late 1960s, many conservatives favored the U.S. effort to support a non-communist government in South Vietnam against Soviet-supported Vietnamese nationalists. Yet a growing group of Americans, especially young people on college campuses, called for an end to the fighting. In the fall of 1969, anti-war demonstrators called for a nationwide moratorium against the war, a day of sit-ins and strikes to protest the war. At UNC, members of YAF loudly defended the war and even threatened to sue any professors who failed to hold class as scheduled. Conservative students often felt outnumbered on campuses like UNC Chapel Hill in the 1960s, but the political networks they developed and the enthusiasm for conservative causes proved increasingly powerful in the years to come. Many early YAF veterans went on to positions of power in state and national government, including as advisors and strategists for Presidents Ronald Reagan, George H.W. Bush, and George W. Bush. The conservative movement they helped create shaped the country in profound ways and continues to influence American life today. Here are the captions that go with this article. Members of the conservative group Young Americans for Freedom, YAF, protest the Pete Seeger concert at UNC Chapel Hill in 1962. The front page of the UNC student newspaper, The Daily Tar Heel, on December 8, 1962, with a headline, Pete Seeger sings to over 1,000 despite YAF and independent pickets. But as a larger headline above that, Tar Heels beat Tigers for first ACC win, 64-58. Another photograph of activist and singer Pete Seeger performing in the 1960s, and also another photograph, signs were the sign of the times in the 60s. This flyer for a radical group was part of the liberal conservative debate. The next article is one of the contest winners for the Tar Heel Junior Historian Magazine article contest. Her name is Alexis Whitworth. She's as a member of the Piedmont Patriot Historians, Piedmont Community Charter School, Matt Richards' advisor, won the 2018 Tar Heel Junior Historian Magazine contest for the intermediate division. Her article is Woolworth's Lunch Counter Sit-In. On February 1, 1960, four students from the North Carolina Agricultural and Technical College went to the F.W. Woolworth store in Greensboro to have lunch. They asked nicely for service, only wanting to enjoy their food. However, as the employees refused service to the men because they were African Americans. Since they were not exactly pleased with the refusal of service, the boys stayed sitting down at the counter until the store closed. The students' names were David Richmond, Franklin McCain, Ezell Baird Jr., now Jabril Kazan, and Joseph McNeil. The day after this first peaceful sit-in, the students came back the following morning right at opening time. This time they were joined also by another 25 students throughout the day. Each day they returned, and by the fifth day, around 300 people had joined the peaceful protest. There were no riots or fights, just people who wanted to be treated equally. Although the protest was peaceful, the police still arrested multiple people and charged them with trespassing. This enraged both the students involved in the first sit-in as well as the people supporting the protest. They decided to stage a large boycott against all discriminating lunch counters that were in the area. Those stores suffered, losing a third of their sales, and store owners were forced to yield to public demand. Finally, after 6 months of protesting and boycotting, the original four men were served at the Woolworth's lunch counter. The effects of that sit-in were huge. During the 6 months of protesting, there were hundreds of blacks and whites, men and women, joining the stand against segregation. Since there was heavy news coverage about the sit-in, it sparked many others across the nation. Main establishments that were protested against were segregated libraries, beaches, hotels, and many others. By April, there were protests in 55 cities in 13 different states, including many in North Carolina. Several people were arrested for disrupting peace, trespassing, and disorderly conduct, and it brought attention. There was so much coverage of the sit-ins, it brought tremendous amounts of attention to the civil rights movement in general. Most reporters covering the sit-ins said they weren't sure how these kinds of actions could affect the relationships between the races. People didn't really realize what was happening and weren't sure if this was something more than just lunch. Some thought it was just a fad that would soon fade away. This did not discourage the protesters at all. If anything, it encouraged them to want to make more of a clear statement about what their actions and intentions were, and they did just that. These protests and comments from the public inspired many others to continue the movement. If those four college students hadn't started this huge string of sit-ins, some of the events in the movement might not have happened. It inspired so many people to stand up for what they believed in, which is incredible. One of the main effects of the sit-ins was the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC, which was founded in Raleigh in 1960. SNCC was a leading force in the civil rights movement. They organized many events throughout the years, including Freedom Rides and the nationally known Washington March. SNCC also teamed up with the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, the NAACP. Together, they worked to push passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, and then later organized a resistance to the Vietnam War. Eventually, the members of SNCC started to include violence in the protests and disbanded in the early 1970s. They had lost much support and popularity and couldn't make any more moves. As you can see, these sit-ins were just the beginning of the civil rights movement, causing people to be louder and prouder about what they were fighting for. Eventually, the people in charge listened. This seemingly small part of the civil rights movement might have been one of the most important ones because it sparked courage of other people to speak about what they believed in. Here's the activities just for fun section. There are a number of them here. One of them, like hands-on learning, check out our Crafting Carolina Educator Notebook for more crafts and activities at ncmuseumofhistory.org/learning/educators/educator-notebooks. While on our website, you can also view the museum's event calendar for more hands-on activities, from one-time make-it-take-it workshops to all-day festivals. Here's one of the activities, peace signs. Have you seen the peace sign symbol? It was first created in 1958 by the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament in England. But in the United States in the 1960s, it was used as a peace symbol, especially among those who were against the Vietnam War. It is still popular today as a universal symbol of peace. Or another one, wear your words. People have worn buttons to share ideas for a long time, most often as campaign buttons to show which politician they supported in an election. In the 1960s, buttons became a popular way to voice other ideas about major issues like civil rights, women's rights, or the Vietnam War. Want to make your own button? There here are a few real ones from the 1960s. You can trace these designs or make your own to express your idea. Draw it, color it, and cut it out to make a button. You can tape a safety pin to the back to wear it. Or turn your design into a cool poster for your wall. Some of them include We Shall Overcome, End Discrimination Now, SNCC, and There's One in Every Crowd, and They Always Find Me. We've run out of time for today's episode of North Carolina History. Be sure to listen next time. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Ed Tremblay, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.